This is tape number 6, the final tape from the Book of Grace, Ram Dass's program at the Upland Hills Ecological Awareness Center, and it took place on February 15th and 16th, 1997.
And it's nothing special. And it's very hard to convey that because people are looking at what you do. You have any powers? Huh? Yes. I'll tell you, I hear your question, and or I think I hear it, and I'm very reticent to define what's chopping wood and carrying water. I think that might be too literal an interpretation. And I mean, in Nepal, where I work, they go out and chop wood still, and what's happened is they've decimated the forests and the rivers are flooding in Bangladesh. And so there are toxicities that apply for many, many situations. And to see the beloved in all, it's interesting when Mother Teresa picks up the lepers in the streets of Calcutta, and they're in their vomit, and it's stuff most people wouldn't want to do. And she seems to be smilingly going about it. And somebody asked her, what are you doing? And she said, I am ministering to my beloved Jesus in all his distressing disguises. Now, whether your car and Western technology is one of the distressing disguises of the mother, and when you open your heart to be in that presence, it can all change at that moment. I mean, I don't question that you're, that's like the person that says, I can be high in Colorado, but I can't be high in New York City, because it's all the man-made consciousness, human consciousness. And I would say, it's all God. And some things, like Caspar Weinberger, it was hard for me to find God there. And it's hard for you to find it in Western technology, because it has components of creating suffering in it. And I would say there's a lot of stuff. In fact, most of us are creating suffering most of the time in our zeal not to. So I think one has to kind of leave behind the judging mode initially in order to just be with what is, out of which comes something different, you know? I mean, I hear what you're saying about why did we let the automobile get so out of hand? You know, why did we do that? Look at it. Look at it. It's filling a quarter of our cities. It's polluting our atmosphere. And it's an illusion that we are perpetuating. That people, we can do that. And I spent a long time being opposed to technology, to science, to things, because I felt that the human mind was a siddhi, a power. The development of the prefrontal lobe was a power that people had developed, and it had gotten out of hand. And people were so impressed, like prehensile capacity a few years before, they were so impressed with this power to plan, remember, think, that they were creating havoc, which we are living in. But the question is, how am I an instrument of the change of that? I can feel that if I polarize the whole scene, that's not going to help me a lot. It's a big one, yes. That's great. That's great. It's very helpful. It's absolutely helpful. That when you, before you externalize evil or the shadow, recognize that in part it's your seeing it. And you're seeing it because there's something in you that gives it reality. It's interesting. It's like the guy that yelled, "Hey," in the subway. How do you change the system? You don't change the system necessarily from inside the system. And it doesn't mean you give up your electricity. It means you give up a place in your mind first. Then you may or may not give up your electricity. Okay? But don't think it's that cheap of just giving up the electricity. See, that's the interesting one. That's the interesting one. Sir?
You mentioned earlier Robert Mueller coined the phrase "the shaping of a global spirituality." My question has to do with whether, from your perspective, Rhonda, you see any of that possibility.
The shaping of a global spirituality. Well, what I'm interested in is the emergence in a larger segment of people who honor a spiritual component of life, but not a religious component of life. And I've got to tell a story that you know, I think, but it's one of my lovely stories. I have a friend who was a speechwriter in Gerald Ford's White House. His name was Milton Friedman, Dr. Milton Friedman. Now, when I talk about Dr. Milton Friedman in government, most of you think of Dr. Milton Friedman, the economist, right? Okay. This was another Dr. Milton Friedman. So one day, his telephone rang, and the caller said, "Is this Dr. Milton Friedman?" And my friend said, "Yes." And the caller said, "Well, I represent a large church in California, and we have a lot of excess funds in our treasury, and we would like your advice as to how to invest them." So my friend Milton Friedman said, "Have you considered giving them to the poor?" To which the caller said, "Is this the real Milton Friedman?" To which my friend answered, "Is this the real church?" So I would say that, like when I see the Dalai Lama visiting with the monks at Gethsemane, when I see people of systems moving across systems, when I see maybe we're running through the cycle of just expending spiritual, physical materialism, philosophical materialism around the globe, and it's like a short thing in which its dis-ease then forces the next level of consciousness, I could say, yes, there is an emerging spiritual awareness. Because I think the conditions are unstable and appropriate enough to force a shift of consciousness, which is really what we're talking about, I think, another way of saying it, you know. So I would say, yes, I think that it's reasonable to experience we are part of a transformative moment that has that potential. You're asking me whether that potential would be realized, and I would say, well, see, I guess I would have to say I don't care. I should care. I want to care, but I don't care. Because it's all part of just the dance of form and formless, and it's okay. So I will work as if it is going to happen. That we are all, the fourth grade is going to become the fifth grade. That the world of physical, material suffering is going to give way to a collective spiritual awareness that is going to allow people to be creative and peaceful and joyful in their lives, collectively together. That's a reasonable statement of a spiritual domain. I'm not sure the fourth grade is supposed to become the fifth grade. I'm not sure the evolution isn't the evolution of individuals, not of collectivity. I'm not sure you want to throw out all the geography books and everything in the fourth grade, because somebody's got to be in the fourth grade. You got to leave it ready for somebody else and then go on. I don't know. I don't know. I will work to make this earth great for the children and the children's children and all. But the attachment to whether that is in the design of things is more than my mind could ever handle. To me, that's a mystery. Is that copping out too much? Or? Yeah.
You talked about that we create the suffering and we see the result of the suffering. And before lunch you said something about suffering being not necessarily related to whether people are hungry or whether they're thirsty or not. Pain and suffering. Do you remember?
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you expound on that a little bit? That would like to do.
When you were a child and you wanted something and you couldn't have it, say your family or somebody said you couldn't have it, you were upset and you suffered. You were suffering. If somebody said to you, are you suffering? You'd say, yes, I'm suffering because I'm not getting what I want. Later, when you're an adult, you can understand more clearly the whole situation, how the person was suffering, but they were suffering because of something they were holding on to in their mind, and there was a deeper wisdom in the community that said, this isn't the right thing, this is going to give you a sick stomach or something like that. I arrived at a place in my own consciousness where I saw that what there are in the universe are phenomena. And how I react to those phenomena will determine whether I suffer or not. Like peristaltic contractions can start in my stomach. Now what happens, my conceptual mind says, I'm hungry. I'm hungry creates a state in which I start to change the world where I see it and focus differently. Just because of that thought, I'm hungry. Instead of, peristaltic contractions in my stomach. You see there's a difference there. What I saw is that there would be pain in my life and that there would be loss and all, but whether I suffered about those things was going to be a function of how my mind worked. And I would be suffering if I didn't allow what is to be. If I say, I'll only be happy if it's sunny out and there's no snow. So now I'm suffering. So I began to see how the mind creates suffering. What Buddha said in his Four Noble Truths was, there is suffering in birth, death, sickness, old age. There's suffering in not getting what you want. There's suffering in getting what you don't want. There's suffering even in getting what you want because it's going to pass with time. So there's even fear inherent in getting it. So there is suffering in life. The cause of suffering, which was the Second Noble Truth, is the clinging of the mind. The attractions and the aversions, the way the mind grabs or pushes. The Third Noble Truth is end the clinging of the mind and you will end suffering. And the fourth of the Noble Truths is what's called the Eightfold Path of how to do the third thing. How to end the clinging of the mind, okay? That's all of what Buddhism is about. It says you can end the clinging, you can end your own suffering. Now, so you hear that whole sequence? So that's the model I'm working with. In other words, when I suffer, I immediately push it back and say, where is my mind clinging? Where am I not allowing the universe to be as it is? There may be pain, there may be discomfort, but if I'm suffering about it, it's different. Because you know, like you could be come home tired from work and you lie down and you just don't want to be disturbed, and then somebody you love calls and suddenly it's all different. You know how your mind works. You can see that it can change in a moment. So I know that suffering is something my mind is creating out of the stuff it's given each day. And I end up to saying, I would like to be free. I would like all beings to be free of suffering. As part of the blessing meditation, may all beings be free of suffering. That includes me. How do I start on carrying that out? First thing I could do is make me free of suffering. So, I now want to become free of suffering. So, I can get high, la-di-da-da-da, and then something comes along and it grabs me and I'm suffering. And I say, it got me. Here I am suffering again. And that focuses my attention on what is it that caught me. And I go to work to center and quiet and open my heart again and come back to the center. Do you see the sequence now? So in other words, when I suffer, I see that as like a light, a traffic light that says, there's something in there to go work on. Go look for it, right? It becomes my yoga or my path. So that's what's for me. But I can't lay that on you, so that when you come up to me and say, hey, I'm hungry, I say, great, must be clinging somewhere. You say, look, all I wanted was, you know, a quarter to buy a cup of coffee, don't give me this crap. Because as my guru said, God comes to the hungry in the form of food. The first thing is if you're suffering because you think you're hungry, that's who you are. If I give you food, I will relieve your suffering. It's not necessarily what I do with myself, but it's what I do with you. In other words, I don't have a right to decide how you can suffer. Your suffering is still suffering, and I'll do my best to relieve it, even though what would be even better for you maybe is if you fasted for a while. Like one person comes up and says, I haven't eaten in 2 days. Another person says, I'm fasting. One of them is suffering, and one of them is delighted. Yeah, I was used to be a yoga teacher, and I put people on these long fasts, just arbitrarily, you know, like, don't eat for a week, you know, or only new tea or something like that. And they'd come in after 5 days, they'd say, I haven't eaten in 5 days. And I'd say, good, you're doing very well. You know, and then I'd go outside on the street, and somebody comes up and says, hey, man, you got a quarter? I haven't eaten in 5 days. Good, you're doing very well. Can you see how inappropriate it is? You see, you listen to hear how a person is working with the suffering to determine what it is you do in relation to them. Is that dealing with your question? Yeah. Yeah.
You early on you said that cultural creatives don't exist in business. Can you expand on that a little?
Cultural creatives what?
Don't exist in business.
No, I said that they don't like business. They don't like big business. I think cultural creatives very much exist in business. That's why I'm in the Social Venture Network, because I think it's full of people who are cultural creatives. I think it exists in every walk of life. I just think sometimes, because that isn't a dimension that's a real one for labeling people, people are busy living with other labels and not acknowledging that they are that. I mean, there are lawyers that are this way, and there are doctors that are this way. And to say, no, I'm just a doctor, isn't really it. This is just giving you another labeling system to bring forth certain qualities in you. But I think I found that an interesting statement that says they're against big business, because I don't think it's interesting to be against stuff. I'm a big embracing and changing through embracing. Like, I like octopi and things like that. But yes, come in. It's an article by Paul Ray, and it's written about, it's in the Noetic Science Journal, and I know it's published in a number of places. I think it's in the Atlantic or somewhere. In what?
In Contact.
In Contact. The Noetics Institute, though, in Sausalito is the one that distributes it. Questions? Yes.
I'd like to respond a little bit more on embracing, like, for example, fear.
On embracing fear? Well, what I sort of mean by embracing fear is sitting with the fear and kind of cozing up to it, edging in on it. Sometimes something awakens fear and it goes, and it's so frightening, you get all reactive out of your fear. And I like to come up to the edge of fear and sort of sit with it and say, ooh, I'm scaring myself, and then there I am scaring myself, and I keep moving in and out of being scared and being a witness of being scared. If you get too scared, it doesn't help. See, there are battles I'm not ready to fight just yet because they're too scary. But I come up, I'm always edging up on them, so I'm hanging out with my fear. And that's a big one around aging, because aging has in it the breakdown of a lot of systems and models you've had about who you are and how you functioned and what role you fulfilled in society and all of it. And you can see all of this as your enemy, but it's also possible to see it as a new moment and a different situation. Take dependency, for example. Our culture has put tremendous value on fierce independence. I don't need anything. Let me take care of you. You get many more rushes, ego-wise, from taking care of people than being taken care of. But what I have noticed in taking care of people is that some people you take care of aren't busy feeling bad because they're dependent and end up enriching my life so much by the way in which they are dependent that it's as if they gave me as much of a gift as I gave them through what I was doing with them, and it was just another human interaction in which we all have our roles to play. And the psychological overlay of the judgment about it had dissolved. And that's interesting inner work for us to do with ourselves. Because there is plenty of fear of chronic illness, fear of cancer, fear of loss of loved ones, fear of dying, fear of loneliness, fear of. If you keep pushing those away, I'm not going to think of them. They keep being like an active force coloring your life. If, on the other hand, you can open to them and just sit with them until you can say, look, I don't want that, but when it comes, what in the past has happened is when things come, I deal with it. I'll deal with that when it comes. It won't be nice, but if I'm going to spend this time now while being frightened about that then, I'm missing now as well as then. So let me at least play with my own consciousness so that I can open to what's all possible and say, yes, that's all true. It's what Castaneda talks about, living with death over your left shoulder. It's living in the presence of all of that stuff that scares you. Until finally, yes, it's all here, and here I still am. What do you know? I still am. Am I dealing with your question at all? No. Yes. I'll repeat. Go ahead.
And I still find myself taking most of the criticism, and I don't think about dying.
She says she's done most of the spiritual practices, or many spiritual practices, for a long time. She still finds herself taking things personally. Huh? Taking things personally. And she doesn't think it's just trying harder that's going to get rid of it. No, because trying harder is a very personal thing. I guess you can just sit with the fact, boy, do I take things personally. I mean, really, that's true. That's what you sit with. And the person who is watching the thing you take things personally isn't taking things personally. That's what's interesting. See, when you say, like somebody comes to me and they say, I'm depressed. I say, you're really depressed. Yes. You completely depressed? Absolutely. You're really, really depressed. Yes, I'm depressed. Is the person who's telling me you're depressed, depressed? Well, no. Yes. Aha! There is a part of you that isn't depressed. It may be 0.1%, and 99.9% is depressed. But there is a witness or a mindfulness or a mindful moment. There's a little place in you that knows. You may screw it over many times and make believe it isn't around, but it is there. I absolutely guarantee you it's there. And it's interesting when you just shut up a little bit. You begin to find it. It's what the Quakers call the still small voice within. And it's sometimes it's really still and really small, but it's in there. And there's a part of you that's just looking at the universe the way it is and saying, ah, so. The rest of you say, I'm depressed, damn it. Shut up, I'm depressed. I remember in the 60s, a woman calling me in the middle of the night up at Millbrook. She dialed from California. And she says, I think I'm about to commit suicide. I've taken LSD and I'm crazy. And she woke me out of a deep sleep. And I heard all this. And I said to her, would whoever looked up my number and dialed 7 numbers plus an area code, could I speak to that person? Because you're out of your mind. I mean, can you imagine somebody calling me to tell me they're crazy? Who am I to believe, you know? Far out. I know some of you say, oh, but she was reaching out for help. True. And I hope I helped her. Then what?
Yeah.
With her?
Yeah.
I don't remember. I think she laughed. I'd like to remember it that way anyway. I think the phone dropped and that was the last I ever knew. I don't know. Any other questions? Yes. It's a really good question. She says, in the world of teenagers, it's getting harder and harder to go through that rite of passage in this culture. And kids are reaching out to drugs more, and if you want to work with teenagers, what is it you can do? Is that the question? Well, the first thing I think is you can be honest, and you can be collaborative, and you can not know what to do with them. In other words, I don't think the game is to do something to them. I think the game is to do something with them. And I think that if you listen hard into a child's world consciousness, I mean, I'm sure you have, but you realize that it's not, that this is a very, that they have a lot on their plate. They have a lot on their plate. Because besides all the nice simple things like endocrine imbalances and economic instability and independence from family and social role change and developing skills, besides all that, they have environmental degradation and the breakdown of adults as role models and the breakup of social structures like families. I mean, it's a good, rich stew, as you and I both appreciate. And so, the first thing I would like is for another human being to know that I appreciate their predicament. That'd be the first thing. So, the first thing is empathy. Empathy to hear my way in deeply enough to the way the world looks to them, to somebody else. So that they can feel heard, so they do not feel that they're alone. They don't feel isolated by their predicament. That's almost the major thing you can do, is to allow another human being to know there's another human being out there. That's the first thing you can do. You can't take away from them their own karma or what they're going to do. You can wrestle with them around the issue that the whole lack of clarity about entering adulthood is because a lot of the mythology of this culture is really dysfunctional. I mean, for example, we have a lot of myths we live by that aren't working anymore. Like, take the myth, take a nice neutral one, like preparing for a career. And yet now the statistics are that people are going to change the direction of their life 4 or 5 times in the course of their adulthood. And yet we still have early models of preparing for a career, which came out of a cultural time when you were apprenticed to your father, for example, okay, or to the local tinsmith. What I have found in the adult drug use culture, that in the inner city crack population, there is a tremendous bitterness about the lack of opportunity, the kind of ceiling on their lives, and the constant in-your-face kind of confrontation through television and everything else about how someone else is living, the rich and famous, People magazine, that world. So it's a constant juxtaposition of what they can't do and don't have and don't have the opportunity to do and what's around. And I think that leads to an escapist behavior, and I don't much blame them. I think it's a stupid escapist behavior, but I don't blame them. In the middle class with cocaine use, which is more the drug of choice of successful middle class America, my best guess is that that comes when somebody has been successful at what they tried to do, and when they did it, it didn't feel like they thought it was going to feel. This is a bizarre one. That they were promised that when they got the security and the this and the that and their children were covered and all this, they were going to feel a certain way, and they don't feel it. And they get into a thing that happens in a society of more is better. Enough isn't enough. More must be better, because enough doesn't feel like enough. Now, when you look at the symptoms of the system from that level, you say, what am I going to do about the teenage dis-ease? Instead of treating the symptoms of it, you look back and you say, what we've got to do is treat some of the social mythology of the culture. We've got to treat some of the opportunities in the culture. I mean, it's really interesting how the job market is a key factor in a lot of social problems in the society. I mean, I think that's absolutely right to deal with it at that level also. So, I mean, a lot of people have been very incensed with me because they assume that I don't see that there is a social problem around drugs in the society, when I absolutely must say that a lot of what has happened to me in my lifetime was the result of my experience with psychedelic chemicals. And I would be a hypocrite to say that these were some evil. It wasn't. At least I'm not experiencing it, and you're paying to hear me. Yeah. So I would say that it isn't necessarily all evil, but yet I can see that chemicals are used in a society in many bizarre ways to escape the pain of life. I mean, I think that the Prozac, Zoloft, that category of chemicals is an extremely interesting social response to a psychic pain in the culture, in which people are feeling depressed and despairing in their lives even when everything seems to be going well. And they say, well, it's a virus or something. And we're using chemicals continually at all levels for everything all the time to avoid some of the pain of life. And I think a lot of it is because we won't look at the pain we are living with in life very collectively, caringly, openly. So I don't know what to say to a teenager. I would listen to the teenager first. I would listen first. And it's hard to listen. It's hard to listen. It's hard to listen. Because you want to say, look, I mean, what I say to kids when they say, should they experiment with chemicals, I say, you've got so much on your plate now. This is not the optimum time to do it. Because you're still becoming somebody. It's too early to start your process to becoming nobody. You really have to solidify your somebodyness. So I do that first. And then when you're established in somebodyness, then explore your nobodyness. And then after you do that, you can be nobody being somebody. That's the game I like to play. I'm nobody being somebody. I appear to be somebody. So I would say that teenage isn't the best time to do that. And as far as chemicals as a spiritual practice, I would say that because it's illegal, I mean, pathologically or not in this culture, that the setting for doing spiritual work with chemicals is tricky business. Because the setting affects the nature of your experience. And when you take it in a paranoid setting, you are increasing the likelihood that you will have some paranoid experience. And having just been down in Brazil, where ayahuasca is part of the established church, I realize that there are circumstances where the culture is saying, come to church, this is a great process, this is a process. That's what Aldous Huxley outlined in his book, Island. For teenagers going through this process as a rite of passage, as an initiation, we don't seem to be that culture at this moment. So, am I dealing with your question? I come back to Gandhi's My Life is My Message. You know, I have a feeling that it's the way you deal with emptiness that becomes part of the problem. That you have to be so at peace. Like, I experience the center of it all as quite empty. And many of the teenagers are feeling something that isn't so far from real. And often we say it's not empty, it's meaningful and rich and full. We've got to be careful where that comes from in us. If it comes from a place where we have lived with and accepted and are comfortable in emptiness and form, then, but otherwise it's just this dialogue. No, it's form. No, it's emptiness. And actually it's both empty and form. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness no other than form. So in a way I see that the kid is, it's like the difference between existentialism and spiritual fullness. This is interesting. I don't think I can articulate it to you. I can just tell you that that's an interesting issue. There's a way in which the experience of emptiness is different than emptiness. And that's it. I am experiencing emptiness is different than emptiness is, of which you are a part. And that's a very incredible mystical little play right there. So that people go into the thing, oh, it's all empty. What they're saying is my experience of it is empty, but there's still a my who's experiencing, and that isn't empty. So throw that into the stew, and when that all comes out empty, then it's interesting. But you aren't. And that's the whole thing about enlightenment. Nobody makes it. Somebody never makes it. Somebody can get to the door but can't get through. But see, don't scare yourself about that surrender. It's enough to surrender from ego into soul. Galumph around for eons of soul till you understand that the souls finally dissolve into emptiness, which of course is all full. Oh well. I'm sorry, I can't help myself. Yes, I try. I try to be responsible. I've been very good today. Yes. Yes? Yeah.
Please flip the tape now and begin side B.